Welcome to New Books and Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from Goldsmiths, University of London. On this episode, I'll be talking to Nick Turnbull about Michel Mayer's Problematology, Questioning and Society, which is published by Bloomsbury. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode of the podcast, I'm talking to Nick Turnbull, who's a lecturer in politics at the University of Manchester, about his new book, Michael Mayer's Problematology, Questioning and Society, which is published by Bloomsbury.
Michel Mayer.
Michel Mayer, right. In fact, we're going to talk about who he is and why you're interested in him, actually. So that'll be something to bring up later on, I think. Before we get into that, could you just tell the listeners a bit about, your kind of intellectual background and why it is you're interested in Michel's work and particularly, actually, why you've written a book about it?
Okay. It's a long route from the concrete to the abstract, I suppose. When I was doing my undergraduate studies in social science policy, it's a very was one of these interdisciplinary departments in a university in New South Wales in Australia. A lot of people from different backgrounds, history, economics, psychology, sociology, and they really saw that in training people to become good workers in public policy, they needed to have a broad background in things. And the unifying concept was always this idea of a policy problem and what this meant, what was policy making, how do we find solutions to public problems. So it was very much in a pragmatic interest in public life. I had a specialism in social policy, I guess, after my undergraduate degree as well. But this interest in public problems and thinking broadly about things in an interdisciplinary way coincided also with, as you do, courses in third year and in fourth year at university with reflecting on methods in social science and the philosophical basis of those methods. And there'd been a lot of questioning from post-structuralists about the basis of scientific knowledge and the implications for power of social science in public life, what it meant working for the state, and all these kind of things we know from sociology. So it just led me to reflect, and I worked in the bookshop, and one day the book buyer was away and they came in with a list of University Press books, and one was called Of Problematology by Michel Mayer of Chicago University Press. And it said, talked about the crisis of metaphysics and in philosophy and how to find a new way forward thinking about questioning and what a question was and what a problem was. And I thought, hey, this looks interesting. I was also interested in political language for precisely the same reason. Policymaking is constructed through language. And it seemed to be a lot of it was rhetoric, so this interested me as well. And I was at I'd been at a bookstore, bookstand, secondhand books, bought a whole bunch of books on rhetoric. And one day I got home and I found that, in fact, it was Michel Mayer's Rhetoric, Language and Reason. I bought it completely separately. And I thought, it's that thing about when two coincidences happen, you know, and I looked into it. And first it was very difficult for me. And but I did read some of it for my honours thesis, which in Australia was like a master's thesis. Then I went away and worked for several years. I worked in politics in the parliament. I worked in the civil service. I worked in the third sector. And I went back to do my PhD. And it was going to be on this idea of policy problems. And I thought, well, let's think about what a problem is. And when you think about what a problem is, and when you ask the question of what a problem is, actually, no one really has a clear idea. And the policy literature is interesting because although it's very practical and pragmatic and it's about real action to change the world, actually, this throws up all kinds of questions that people don't normally ask. And one of them is this idea about problems and solutions and questions. And so I delved into Mayer's work and I thought, this is a guy that's saying something completely new about questioning and about logic itself and about knowledge itself. So in the end, it's burrowing right down to brass tacks about what is knowledge and what is it to ask about what the world is. And then it's been a long trajectory coming back up in a sense. So moving back from the abstract to the concrete isn't quite so easy when you've got this different philosophical system. But he's not well known. He's published a lot. To talk more about him, to move on, if you like an answer to that question. So he's a Belgian philosopher. He's in his mid-60s. He's due to retire soon. He's at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, of the University of Brussels. He's professor of philosophy and rhetoric there. And his intellectual ancestors, well, his descendants, he's a descendant of the rhetoric chair there from Chaim Perelman. Perelman was well known for reintroducing Aristotelian rhetoric in the 20th century. So he founded the journal, the Review Internationale de Philosophie, in the 1930s, and wrote a number of books on rhetoric that were very influential. Really, it was about reintroducing this Aristotelian idea, and Perelman's best known, actually, as a legal theorist, but also in the field of argumentation. So Meyer was Perelman's student, and Meyer's work's very different from Perelman's, right? It's philosophically very different. But in fact, what Perelman saw in problematology was actually a way to counter the Habermasian view of communicative action. Meyer told me a story about when Habermas went to Brussels to give the keynote lecture there. Perelman was a bit dismissive at the time, as was his character, but he referred to Habermas's theory as a peace and love rhetoric. But we know the utopian basis of the work, and plenty of people have criticized it. But nonetheless, it has a great deal of value, and I think, especially when looking at public policy and political discourse, procedural ethics is vital, I think, in democracies. But nonetheless, Perelman saw in the courtroom it wasn't about reaching agreement. In fact, it was about the rhetoric of conflict. And that's something that Habermas's theory simply doesn't deal with. And for Meyer, quite rightly, with rhetoric, had been marginalized from rationality, and this dates back to Plato, of course. The very origins of Western philosophy were the condemnation of rhetoric. And Aristotle attempted to rehabilitate rhetoric somewhat, but he left it divided from philosophy, from science. Perelman's reintroduction of rhetoric on the Aristotelian lines was partly in response to 20th century problematization, especially in a country like Belgium, wrecked by the war, split between language communities as well. Rhetoric of conflicts obviously was central. How do we have argumentation without going to war? This seemed fairly obvious for Perelman. For Meyer too, rhetoric had to be rehabilitated, not as anti-reason, but integrated within reason, so that it could be located within a philosophy and grounded, otherwise it would be seen as relativist. So here you have Meyer's interest in rhetoric. So on the one hand, questioning is a foundational view. On the other hand, the other pillar of his work is a theory of rhetoric, which relates to the theory of society. So hence my book on Meyer deals with these two aspects: questioning as a philosophy and as a social science activity, and understanding questioning in society, which partly concerns rhetoric.
I mean, there are two themes in the book there, and I guess they might usefully come together in this quite kind of straightforward question of, so what is problematology?
Yeah. Problematology is a philosophy. It's a metaphysics. It is simply the questioning of questioning. Rather than ontology, the questioning of being, or epistemology of knowledge, it's looking at questioning in a new way. Now, of course, we know philosophers have always questioned. Academics have always questioned. So what Meyer is doing is proposing something really radical, which is that despite all this questioning, they have not actually reflected upon questioning for itself. And one can object, say, well, Wittgenstein talks about questioning a lot, but actually he doesn't question questioning itself. It's a theme in the work. Socrates, the arch questioner, yet he doesn't reflect much on what the answers might be. He uses questioning to show that the sophists don't have the solutions that they claim to, that in fact they're really problematic. So Meyer looks at many aspects of philosophy over the course of his career, and he says questioning, in fact, has been suppressed, and philosophy has not reflected upon its very practice. So this idea of the division between theory and practice, by questioning, his argument is he can recover philosophy in its most fundamental element, which is to ask questions and to produce problematic answers. So I can go through the many aspects of the argument, but essentially what he does is he says that in contemporary history, since Marx, Nietzsche, Freud, and others in the 20th century, there's been the destabilization of metaphysics. Now, we know the post-structuralist response, which is the twilight of metaphysics, or the end of metaphysics. The task itself is redundant of searching for foundations. It conclusively cannot be found. Well, but others have pointed out the contradiction. Can't make a statement. The principle is that there are no principles. It's paradoxical. So some post-structuralists will live with the paradox and deal with it. Simon Critchley is a contemporary philosopher who does that. And to me, this seems more consistent. Others, like Laclau, turn Derrida or Heidegger into a system of thought by trying to build in these problematic concepts. But for Meyer, in fact, there can be a foundation to reason, and that in a period where everything is in question, the response should not be to echo the problematic and allow it to be negative, but actually to ask, what is questioning? And you find, despite the seeming novelty of the argument, Jakob Hintikker, who's an analytical philosopher, says much the same thing, that questioning has not really been considered. And his analytic works do very interesting things with this as well.
It's interesting because the book opens with his encounter with Heidegger.
Yes.
And right through the book, it's clear that there are, you know, really kind of, I guess, similar tasks that those two philosophers had in terms of reconstructing what it means to do philosophy.
Yeah.
Except for one of them, it's reconstructing it around ontological questions and ideas about being. But for Meyer, it's reconstructing it around questions and problems.
Yeah.
And the idea that almost, you know, to question is before or comes prior to being.
Indeed. And this is Meyer's point, is that in taking the ontological view, which people simply presume, I mean, if you put to people that questioning comes before being, they simply don't believe it. They say that it's the question of being that counts, because they accept Heidegger's view. But yet, when Meyer went to meet Heidegger, and Heidegger invited him there when he was only 21, Heidegger confirmed with him that, in fact, yes, questioning was the key. But someone who revealed questioning, who appreciated this, would never be understood, because people wouldn't understand the question itself, because it was too radical. Very prophetic, but, you know, so far it turns out to be right. But if we ask the question of what is, or we ask the question of what is language, or we ask the question of what is God, it doesn't matter. In each case, the question comes first. So Meyer reflects, well, in that case, questioning is the first principle of thought. And if you question that, you confirm the answer. Now, you can reject the question and say, as many post-foundationalists do, this is a redundant enterprise. But in fact, to do so is already to presume the answer and to have an idea of what an answer might be. But it seems that, you know, I've never met anyone who can tell me that this is incorrect. So questioning comes first in a practical sense. And also here, we have a human activity that everyone undertakes. One doesn't need to be a philosopher to do it. But philosophy should be reflecting on the very practices of thought. And what's first in thought is questioning itself, no matter who you are and what activity you undertake. Meyer is very clear that any activity we undertake, any words we speak, any thoughts we think, we have a question in mind. By reflecting upon that, we can bring out the nature of that knowledge.
I mean, this reconstruction of the activity of philosophy is engaged not just as a kind of theoretical exercise, but in practical terms about distancing and dissociating philosophy from the natural sciences. And actually in the book, then you take this on and point out how this might work for the social sciences as well. So I wonder if you could explain the kind of the distinction that Meyer is trying to make, and then how this distinction matters for social science.
Okay. So the key distinction he makes is if you have the question, the first principle of thought, and then you ask the question about what that is, we're using language to talk about it. And it's a similar move one finds in Descartes, it's a similar move in many philosophies. But by thinking of it in terms of questioning, you get a different result. So we're already in language. We can talk about a primary question. We can't give it form, because that would be to presuppose an answer to it. We can say that it is a question. We can reflect that question, even if we can't say definitively what it is. Therefore, language reflects questioning. Right? Therefore, it's a solution to it. But it's a solution in a different sense. Language responds to a fundamental question of giving it voice, but it doesn't eliminate it. So the key presupposition he's addressing is the presupposition that answers eliminate questions. Some answers do. So he calls that the apocritical element, which comes from Greek apokrisis, which means to resolve a problem. But discourse also produces questions. It doesn't eliminate them entirely, so it's problematological. So this difference between the apocritical and problematological is what he terms the problematological difference. And this is, just emphasize the radicality of this, is a new logic itself. It's not about the division of knowledge into reality and knowledge of that reality, into the ideal and the real and all these many divisions that we know, which post-structuralists have rightly criticized as binding oppositions. The apocritical and the problematological are not opposed ontologically. They each occur within every instance of thought. So he has a way to talk about the determinate, what's an answer, and the indeterminate, what remains in question. So therefore, we have a way to talk about stability and change in society, and that's the theme that I try to develop through the book. And it's really a radical difference. And by articulating these two things, not only does he tell us we can answer questions, as science very effectively does, we see it in practice. Whatever the criticisms of positivist rationality, science is very effective, otherwise we wouldn't be recording this interview today. At the same time, he gives the indeterminate a positive content by making questioning a positive aspect, by refusing to repress it in the answer. All ontology, the philosophy of being, presumes that being has to resolve the question. So then Heidegger comes along and says there's always a radical indeterminate other, and therefore this produces radical negativity. It's not negative in Meyer. Why should it be negative? This is a presupposition. So when he accuses Heidegger of being a nihilist, you can see why, because it's the radical negation. Now, problematology shows us we simply don't have to accept that. We can give contingency a positive aspect, and we can make it intelligible by calling it problematological. If I face a question, okay, that's an issue for me. Maybe I don't have an answer. That doesn't throw me into crisis. That's not a crisis of rationality at all. It's simply a prompt to look for answers. I may have no certain answers, especially in contemporary society where everything is more liquid or whatever metaphor you like to use. It's a way to articulate that contingency in a positive sense. And so we have a philosophy that does many of the things that post-foundationalists want, but actually, to the contrary, asserts a foundation and gives the problematic a positive content. So that all his work is really to articulate that problematological difference to unravel and explain existing paradoxes in philosophy.
And it gives, I suppose, philosophy a job that is not the same as science.
Absolutely, yes. So one of Meyer's key themes has been that ever since Aristotle, in fact, scientific, what resolves problems and makes them go away, and might be what he would call dialectic and rhetoric and poetics, in which problems persist, is a different class of reason. So, and we see this many years later in the two cultures problem. Now, by articulating problematology, Meyer is keen to show that there are different kinds of answers and they can appear on a spectrum. So on the one hand, he wants to explain scientific rationality by showing that, indeed, it's the most highly developed form of rationality we have. It provides rigorous answers to questions. It lines them all up together. It doesn't have to be perfectly predictive, as we know that it's not. There's always some skepticism involved. But by showing that the problematological is equivalent to the apocritical, here we have a way to say, well, what does philosophy produce? Philosophy produces problematic answers. Science ridicules philosophy. And you hear scientists making jokes about philosophy all the time, of finding nothing. But what philosophy does is articulates questions in new ways, which are themselves kinds of solutions. And you could take, certainly the application here applies the same to literature. Highly figurative literature of the 20th century. How do we understand Kafka or Calvino? We understand it by the fact that it articulates questioning itself by looking at the question of meaning. And in fact, Meyer's reading of Kafka is quite different from Derrida's. He shows that how do we understand the meaning? We see that the meaning is a question which has no necessary resolution. So in social science, we have somewhere in between the natural sciences and the arts. Social sciences, we don't deal with the enigmatic so much. Some people do like to draw on the humanities, and there's a lot to be taken from them with engagement from the humanities, especially when it comes to culture and like political culture or the study of art and literature. Social science produces answers to its questions, but these are contingent. And so for me, what it does is it puts the general constructivist approach on a very firm footing and explains why its answers remain necessarily more contingent than one finds in physics or in chemistry.
It's really interesting that in doing that, the book goes on to show how this might apply in a range of different contexts, in things like politics or the idea of history or thinking about the emotions. And we might turn to them and take them one by one. But before that, one of the things that struck me going through the introduction was a particular moment where you talk about the idea of problematology doing three things of integrating and dealing with values, emotions, and the material world together, which often is separated out in particular philosophical traditions or philosophical approaches. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about the kind of the act of integration, which again in the book kind of marks problematology out as more useful than other approaches.
Yeah, I think for me, that's the key problematology. It's integrative and tries to unite across disciplines and across concepts. And it's really remarkable how unpopular such a view is. People simply don't want it. Even if they're not postmodernists, nonetheless, they seem to have taken on this idea that it can't be a foundation to reason and therefore you can pick whatever you like. An integrative view is somehow Hegelian totalization. Now, Mayer would say he's trying to do something like Hegel or like Aristotle, but in a different way, by articulating a problematic rather than a system of thought with a firm trajectory in history. So what he does is he articulates in terms of questionings the fundamental human activity. We reflect upon ourselves. Human beings question themselves in ways that we think animals probably don't. We question each other because we live in complex societies. So there's always a problem. Right? There's the individual and the collective. But the questions we ask come in three forms, which is the question of the self, the question of the world, and the question of the other. And he articulates how this is very similar in all kinds of social theories and philosophies. Descartes has the three discourses. Kant similarly has the three critiques. Bourdieu has the three forms of capital. Giddens has the three types of the modern state and so on. The question of the self, the other, and the world, therefore, he sees them as a universal system for articulating and integrating these aspects because they sit within a fundamental questioning activity. So in terms of the self, we have our values, we have our which represent the answers that we accept, the norms, if you like, in sociology, or our ethics, which in rhetoric refers to the ethos. Who we are is what we project to others, and others judge us according to those values and the projection of our character. So in politics, when a political leader speaks, we're judging him or her according to a whole series of things. One of those will be the values and what we think that they stand for. So where they will provide answers and rather than change their mind all the time. The world is logos, the material, what is reality, in other words. Now, for Mayer, reality is what it is. It's not created by human beings, but what it is for us is different because it's separated from us by a questioning process. Reality is the answers that it gives us, and that can vary from one point in history to another, from one culture to another. But nonetheless, the questioning of reality is the necessity in both cases. Then there's also the question of the other. We are separated from one another as individuals. So we react through our emotions from the other, hence the connection to pathos in rhetoric. We always experience those as an emotional sense according to how distant someone is from us. And conflict stems from our relationships with the other and through the emotions. So in these three questioning types of questions or articulations of the fundamental questions about what we are and what the world is, we have this way to integrate. And by articulating them as questions, self, world, and other, he sees what many other philosophies have in common. And I think he's really saying something universal about the human condition. And it's very interesting because, on the one hand, it's universal, and he can identify these articulations throughout different periods of history. And we can take them even in the most mundane aspects, the rhetoric of the Wizard of Oz, is ethos, logos, and pathos of the three characters on a quest for something. And that's what we are. We ask questions as we go through life. We find the answers nourish further questions, and so on. The questioning never ceases. There's no final definition according to who we are. But in having that questioning in common, we have a universal nature and something that's the basis for solidarity, as much as it might also be the basis for our differences.
And this raises a challenge, as you do later on in the book, for various post-foundationalism, post-modernism, post-structuralism. And in the book, you kind of think about this through the lens of politics. So there are various kind of key thinkers, Laclau being the most obvious one, but also you engage a little with Derrida and these kind of political questions, Lefebvre as well. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about what the implications for politics might be in contrast to those, say, post-foundationalist thinkers that have attempted to integrate a rejection of foundations into their political systems and their political thought.
Okay. I think to preface that question by this idea about history and questioning history, Mayer's criticism of Heidegger and Derrida and others is that what they do is they reflect the problematization of thought rather than seek to rationally account for it. So it's a celebration of defundamentalization. It's a celebration of radical conflict when it comes to its expression in the political. So I think those thinkers are right to look for an understanding of politics and the political in difference, in a fundamental difference. But what they do is they conflate the political with the problematic. Mayer shows us that, in fact, if we take a positive view, we can take a philosophical view, which for a start means we've got an anchored system of reason. And in so doing, it gives the politics a positive quality. Why should politics be based on radical negativity? Why should the political represent the fragmentation or the destruction of rationality on an everyday basis? I don't see why politics should be so negative. Aristotle certainly didn't have a negative view of politics. And again, you see in the post-foundational views their origin in Plato and the totalizing view, but they're simply seeking to overturn it by taking the people in the cave as maybe having something to say, by taking the impossibility of a foundation of reason in an ontological sense as positive. Aristotle hardly mentions Plato. Aristotle has a view of politics as being very positive. Now, we can talk about rhetoric later, I suppose, but he said that the human being is political man. I think Mayer would agree. By looking at politics as derived from questioning, we can see it as simply one modality of questioning if we take it as a problematological answer, but it's not the only one. Why should everything be political? There's lots of things about literature that simply aren't political, yet they speak to us culturally and about our society. The same with art. Is the enigmatic in art an expression of the political? I think this is taking it too far. And that's the problem with post-Heideggerian foundationalism is it's had made that argument about knowledge and then it's going through this period of ascending to the political, but it simply takes it too far. I think they're right to say the political is found in a fundamental, undecidable difference. What should we do about the problem of political violence? Well, we can negotiate, we could ban it, we could attack. There's all kinds of solutions, none of which are necessary. But that doesn't mean that there's some radical undecidability about it. It simply means they're questions that we need to answer. So Mayer has a way of articulating the political in a very positive sense, but still bringing out this idea of indeterminacy. And then we look at public policy, which is where I originally started. Public policies aren't permanent solutions to problems. They're a way to resolve a conflict that's going on, to resecure the legitimacy of the state and social order in so doing, and then they're questioned again on a different basis. So it's a kind of incrementalism, and there's certainly we can see the power that's involved in that. But we can also see that politics appears, but then is resolved. Where is it resolved? It's resolved into law. Constitutions provide a deproblematizing basis for most societies, simply not political. It could be political if it's questioned, brought into question as maybe something we should change, as, for example, with the Scottish referendum. But that doesn't mean that this the eruption of unreason in the everyday, as though that could only be possible if normal activity were to be that no one questioned anything. And of course, that's never been true in human society.
And the thing that follows both in the book and I think quite straightforwardly from that is to think about what the role of emotion, or as Meyer calls it, the passions, are within this.
So he has a, I deal with the chapter in the book on the passions, mainly it comes from Meyer's very complicated book on the history of the passions. And his idea there is, again, to overturn the ontological partition of reason and passion, or reason and emotion. And indeed, this has been the subject of all great philosophers have looked at this question. So his argument, once again, is that if you look at it ontologically, as Plato did, you have the man of reason, then you have the man blinded by passion. So the occupants of the cave looking at the shadows on the wall, they need to see the light in order to escape the cave, but they can't. So who can do it? The philosopher king, Plato himself. Only the true intellectuals can repress their passions and see beyond them and make wise decisions. So it's a justification for fascist rule, very clearly, I think. But how does one make the leap from living in the cave to seeing without? And, of course, the adherents, if they're taken out of the cave, they're blinded by the light of reason. They can't apprehend it, so they decide to flee back in. If they're in the cave, they have no reason to think that reality is not what lies before them. So you have this division of reason and passion. And Meyer's argument here, again, is that this stems from the ontological viewpoint. And he cites Aristotle, who has a very variegated theory of the passions. It's quite ambivalent and very textured, and he doesn't try to put them into totalizing a form. He deals with them in poetics. He deals with them in the rhetoric as well. So Meyer's view is, how do we articulate reason and passion? How do we integrate passion within reason but still allow reason to emerge? Now, the post-foundationalist approach is to say that all rationality is impassioned and the emotions are involved, and therefore scientific rationality falls apart. Meyer rejects this view. And he does it using the problematological difference once again, which can provide autonomy in the apocritical while still preserving some element of the problematic. So he develops a theory of the consciousness in terms of questioning and rhetoric. So we have our two parts of consciousness, what we're in, the activity in which we're immersed, and then reflection upon that activity. And even I saw Kahneman was at here recently. It matches perfectly with the most behavioral psychology around, as well as with, you know, resonates with much in terms of theory of practice and sociology. We can, those two activities simply can't occur at the same time. There's a temporal distance between them. So how do we achieve the constancy of the real? I go out of the office every day. The world is potentially new for me every time. When I moved to Manchester from Australia, everything was quite new. Certainly was a lot darker than I was used to. And
a lot wetter.
A lot wetter, yeah. But I didn't know where anything was. And when you're in a new place, you at first have a lot of questions and you have to do a lot of search and discovery. But as you obtain those solutions, you become immersed in familiar routines. And this is not simply a rational choice where one rationally selects one's goal in an instrumental way and goes off and pursues it. Actually, repeated actions give us this feeling of comfort and security in the world, and that's the passions at work. And so what he says is the questions that we might ask every day, where am I going, what am I doing, are those people threatening to me or not, are made rhetorical, so the idea of a rhetorical question. So the questions are rendered rhetorical, and then our unconsciousness simply can't get away with this. So it covers up the rhetoricization of those questions using the passions. So in my repeated journeys to work every day, they become very familiar. So I gain pleasure from making these questions rhetorical by feeling that there really is no question to ask. And so we have the basis for all kinds of social norms, ideologies, prejudices. And it's why we like to engage in them so much. Christmas has a particular meaning, all kinds of social rituals. Going out to rock concerts is something we might enjoy even if we think the band's pretty poor. I like going to the movies, even if the movie's rubbish, I still enjoy it because it's the activity of going to the movies, all the things we know from social anthropology and sociology. So we have this idea of the consciousness operating as making questions rhetorical and using the passions to cover them up. At the same time, different kinds of passions can appear over time. So I'm going to Manchester in another 10 years, the same office, the same way. Perhaps I start to feel a sense of boredom, anxiety, which is my consciousness prompting me to say, well, maybe you should start questioning this. Maybe you should be doing something else. Now, the problem with contemporary society is we have so many choices. It's the age of choice. So we're constantly being prompted with a kind of anxiety. Bauman writes about this very well. Beck too, and many others. Right? Thinking Richard Sennett in terms of
if you go back to Zimmel and his encounters with cities.
Right, absolutely. There are so many questions to face, so much anxiety. So we're constantly trying to repress problems as much as we're trying to encounter them. And this is again the problematological dialectic. On the one hand, we have the desire to repress the emotions, to hypocritically annul problems. On the other hand, we have the drive to problematization. So our consciousness performs these tricks for us to give us security in the real. And at certain times in life, one finds questions come before you about maybe your relationship, maybe your job, maybe where you are, the whole meaning of it all. And these aren't necessarily productive questions. I'm thinking of a famous example, perhaps Tiger Woods, who had such confidence. He was a brilliant golfer. But his personal life fell into question. Everybody questioned him about it. And then he seems to have been unable to recover that confidence ever since. We could think of maybe some great footballers who fell into the same process. And sometimes people who don't ask questions of themselves are the most successful people because they simply refuse to take on the question of others. They simply do not admit into their mind those kind of questions that trouble most normal people about who they are and where they're going. So we have this idea of the passions involved, not separate from reason. On the one hand, they're involved in the maintenance of the real. On the other hand, they're involved in the questioning of the real. So the scientist can question reality at its most fundamental. Here in Manchester, we have the graphene scientists. They can ask, what is this new substance we've made? We can ask new questions about reality at a quantum level. And there's passion involved in that search. But that doesn't mean the activity is not rational, because the hypocritical aspect makes autonomous from that questioning process a different kind of series of answers which can be lined up in a different process. So as social scientists, we're passionate about what we do. Well, we love it sometimes. Maybe we're bored with it. But the solutions we find can be more or less strong and still very scientific. So here he tells us that the emotions are integral to human beings, to being what it is to be human, but partly in the fact that we seek to repress questions as much as to ask them. And we have a variegated view of the emotions as the articulation of the difference between the answer and the question.
The final substantive chapter in the book deals with rhetoric explicitly and this idea of social distance. And distance is absolutely key, yeah. I think, to Mayo's philosophy, as is rhetoric. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about this idea of distance, how it's important to or interact with rhetoric as a way of kind of closing the book.
Okay. The distance idea is new for Mayer, and he does speak about it in terms of rhetoric. I think for me, it was also interesting because it resonates with so much contemporary sociology in terms of understanding social space. This part of his thought is where his philosophy turns into a kind of social theory. Now, we find distance in Aristotle's rhetoric. So Aristotle articulates the state of the various audiences. It's first kind of social psychology. How do you appeal to an audience that is fearful? They're fearful because something to be feared seems close at hand and is perhaps unknown. They're confident when that danger can be put at a distance. We already have that idea of distance. But also there's a temporal distance in history. Even at the most minute level between the immediate and the reflective consciousness, there's a temporal distance. And hermeneutics has been about reaching across historical distance to try to understand the past and see how it speaks to us in the present. So we have many of these ideas of distance. So what he does is, rather than social differences simply being a difference of a being and the other in an ontological sense, it becomes a question. And that question is distance. And he uses distance to articulate the relationship between ethos, logos, and pathos. So when it comes to a speaker and an audience, or a writer and a reader, whatever that is, rather than use Aristotle's means of persuasion to talk about that discourse, and in fact, when it comes to literature, poetry, art, there is no persuasion at work. It's figures evoking emotional responses. What it is about the distance between the speaker and the audience. In the job of in persuasion, the speaker attempts to persuade an audience to bring them closer to him or her, and that speaker becomes the ethos, the audience is pathos, and the question is logos. So he has this integration of the Aristotelian theory in an embedded social theory. So rather than there be an ontological separation between being and the other, which always seems to be too radical to me, people say, well, someone's being represented as an other. There's a difference in kinds of others, it seems very clearly. And lots of conventional empirical sociology has quantitative measures of distance and or subjective interpretations of feeling thermometers and so on. So here we have a distance as a question, which can be partially resolved. Perhaps we agree to disagree. Perhaps by agreeing we become closer in the Habermasian deliberative method, or perhaps by being put at a rhetorical distance, we're further apart on a question, and we see rhetoric used to create division as much as to resolve it. But the solution to the question, therefore, can be multiple. In problematology, there is no yes or no answer at the base because questions have multiple solutions. So in terms of distance, we can be at the very least the same, further, or closer, which I think for the future gives a nice three-part methodological structure, actually, by which you could then interpret rhetoric in regard to other social forms. So the key here is distance, that whenever we have a question between us, what's at stake underneath is the distance. So the distance between us is represented through that substantive question. That may be, what do we do about a political problem? That may be one that's simply glossed over, say, in terms of a class relation, an encounter between a wealthy homeowner and a tradesman coming to the house. Both parties can tell by their dress, by their residence, all of these things about their cultural differences. What they do is they use rhetoric to set up a discourse that glosses over those distances, precisely because they wish to avoid conflict. And here he said something about rhetoric for which it's always been accorded approbation. The avoidance of conflict is just as important in society as its articulation and explication. Politics deals with the explication of problems we want to deal with. Because they're producing social tensions, we need to politicize them. So politics is a partial solution to those questions. But there are many others for which we simply don't want to bring up. One of them is class differences. So we have ways of recognizing those differences, but without raising them. This is why there's not conflict all the time. So Marx's idea of false consciousness, we could say, is quite wrong. People are willing participants in these rhetorical forms because what do we want to go about our business day to day? We want a peaceful life. We only want to deal with problems that we feel capable of dealing with at the time. So in politics, the key problem of leadership is, when do you introduce a new problematic? When do you require the population to ask questions about their society? Or when do you simply leave it alone and think that maybe in the long run we need to address this much further down the track because societies won't handle it? And we see poor leadership can be radical in prompting questions as much as it can be too conservative.
That's really interesting. And it's particularly interesting the way this brings us back actually to practical everyday questions that we see when we open the newspaper or turn on the television. Yeah. So I guess that the place to kind of finish is to see where you're going next. I mean, it's clear that one of the book's purposes is to introduce problematology to English speaking audience, sure, that, you know, hasn't encountered it before. As well as that, are you doing other work around this, or are you moving on to a kind of completely different project, having staked out this introduction?
Yeah. I think what I'd really like to do, I mean, being an empirical social scientist at heart, is to turn this into a kind of method which I can use without having to. I think the interdisciplinary aspect is crucial. At the end of the book, I explain about how distance can be seen through all different disciplines at once. So sociology looks at structural distances, which are often unseen and untreated. Politics attempts to move distances. Law looks at making judgments on distances. And psychology is the experience of distanciation, hence recognition, misrecognition, and so on. Now, there's something I think can be integrated within all that by using various kinds of methods. So to me, the idea is to look at, move rhetoric away, actually, from a more humanities interpretive orientation towards something that can be quite methodologically encountered in a more, I don't want to say fixed, in a constructivist view that enables us to measure it and link it up with other kinds of quantitative social science. So to look at structured distances in a sociological sense and how rhetoric mediates across them and annuls them, seems to me with this kind of idea of rhetoric, we have an idea of how rationalizations occur for individuals. And again, I'm thinking about that class conflict. Bourdieu, in his books, talks a lot about rationalization, but he never really seems to actually theorize it very adequately in terms of the method. But here we have a way to explain the modification of distance. And in politics, we have a way to explain how opposition can be annulled by reducing distance in a rhetorical sense without really addressing underlying political structures. So there's really something to be said about rhetoric as a surface activity that nonetheless has a deeper function. So one of the papers I'm working on now with a colleague in international political economy is the Eurozone crisis. And constructivist readings of the Eurozone crisis, now a very strong one, is the idea that austerity is the dominant idea, restricted state spending is the key. And we think that's certainly important. But the negotiation of the Eurozone crisis doesn't bear that out because there's been several instances when things have been said that were against that quite clearly. For example, Mario Draghi's statement about we'll do whatever it takes to save the euro. And even in the latest days, we see the Germans rejecting the Greek olive branch. Now, is it only to stick to the austerity idea? No, I don't think so, because we know that there's a will to punish them because of a kind of ethics. They've made a judgment that their entry into the Eurozone was done unfairly, and they almost have a will to punish them. And here we see quite rhetorical processes at work. So it's not just the idea of austerity, although that is partly built into the monetary union. But we have this idea of negotiation as rhetorical negotiation of distance. And we see from the early stages what was important was to keep the Eurozone together. So we have this idea of a Keynesian moment. I don't think it was particularly Keynesian. It was more about a practical orientation about distance. The idea of economic ideologies is one of the things that sets the distance between the members. But some members were moving away in a sort of variegated sense, and others were coming closer along with the austerity idea. But we can see with argumentation as a negotiation of distance how that takes place on a number of fronts. And really what's at stake is, as we know, the institution of monetary union itself, and even potentially the European Union itself, as a limited distance that's defined by certain things. So there's a geopolitical aspect. There's an aspect of ideas as a kind of distance. And there's this narrative about who's deserving and who's not of Eurozone membership, who's deserving of assistance and who's not. Hence all the very ethical judgments being made very unfairly about the peripheral countries, and also the counter judgments about, well, actually what needs to happen is some inflation within Germany to balance out the balance of payments problem. So we see the material in there as well. So we have values, emotions, and materiality all interlinked. And what they're not only are they interlinked in a conceptual sense, we can see the role of each, but we can see how they're expressed in this everyday relation between ethos, logos and pathos. The negotiation of questions all underneath lies this question about distance. So I think that's one thing I'm working on now.
It's a good empirical test, actually.
It is a good empirical test, yeah. I think. And it still shows the constructivist view. It's very much solidly constructivist view in IPE. But it takes into account various criticisms. So from historical institutionalists who say, well, actually, paradigm shifts don't occur by radical shift in ideas. Actually, paradigm shifts are a result of history in which a set of answers come and new questions come to be accepted and the previous ones rejected. If they were simply an epistemic shift, the same problem of the Meno paradox that I write about in the book emerges again. How can one see a new paradigm if one's located within it? One simply can't see outside the cave because one's blinded. But if we have a question, we face a question, we don't know the answer, but we know what it is insofar as it's a question. So we can treat it. And we can go through a series of partial answers, and what emerges is what emerges. Will the Urizen emerge intact as a coherent limited distance? Maybe not. Maybe they will do whatever it takes to save the Euro. And in which case we can see other kinds of ideologies are being placed in there. But here it's very much a pragmatic, practical rationality that shows how people engage in smaller questions in the everyday mechanisms that are about the distance from the other fundamentally, and therefore they're political. And they design institutions to try and fix those distances, and then they adjust them in order to maintain them, to allow them to increase and so on. And ultimately, political power is about who gets to set those distances and who's able to modify them. Hence the power struggle in the European Union at the moment.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from Goldsmiths, University of London. On this episode, I was discussing Michel Mayer's Problematology, Questioning in Society with the author Nick Turnbull. The book was published by Bloomsbury.